You've downloaded the Scottish Poetry Library podcast. Please help us out by subscribing. It's very easy and it's totally free. Just click on the iTunes link on your browser. Now enjoy the show. Hello, welcome to the Scottish Poetry Library podcast. I'm Ryan Van Winkle, your friendly reader in residence. And today we've got a great show for you today. We've got Mario Petrucci, the poet, scientist, and all-around fantastic guy, sat down with me in London and had a phenomenal conversation. The man has an invigorating mind, and it was really, really a pleasure to sit down and talk to him. And I hope you enjoy the interview. So that'll be coming up in a minute. But first, we're in Edinburgh, and it's August, and that means it's festival madness. There's the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, the International Festival, loads of free festivals and fringe festivals and book fringe. And, of course, the Edinburgh International Book Festival is on. And there's a program of amazing stuff that the Scottish Poetry Library and Don Patterson have helped program. There's a whole strand of poets coming, including Paul Muldoon, John Glenday, Carolyn Duffy, Jackie Kay, the big hitters. Seamus Heaney, of course, is coming. There's more. I mean, check the International Book Festival site or the Scottish Poetry website for all the poets that are coming. It's great. Tom Leonard will be here. He's reading at the Word Power Book Fringe. I love Tom Leonard's poetry. Go see that if you get a chance. That'll be free. There's a whole series of free events at the book festival called Unbound. A.L. Kennedy is doing her one-woman show there. There's going to be a special Golden Hour show there with Withered Hand and Black Diamond Express. It'll be amazing. There'll be loads of dancing, and there'll be some poems and readings and stuff from surprise guests. Who else? Oh, McSweeney's. For God's sake, we've got McSweeney's coming to Edinburgh to do a big show at the Spiegel Tent. I was talking to the Roland, the programmer, and whatever McSweeney's is planning, it seems to be breaking some of their heads because it's a bit ambitious. So go down to see McSweeney's at the Spiegel Tent. It'll be amazing. What else were we just saying that was good at the Spiegel Tent? Discombobulate from Glasgow. All our friends from Glasgow are coming through. Alan Bissett is one of those guys. The Year of Open Doors with our friend Raj Glass and Burnt Island. They're doing stuff. Oh, and Writer's Block, the great local collective of writers from here in Edinburgh, featuring the great Gavin Ingalls and Jane McKee. They're doing a free event at the Spiegel Tent. So there's like a whole program of late night stuff at the book festival and the beautiful Spiegel Tent that you can't miss. And I'm doing a bunch of programming. You know, I'm doing the Golden Hour at the Forest, and I've got my one-on-one poetry performance happening at the Forest Fringe. You can check the website for details of that stuff. But basically, we'll be covering all of this stuff. I know it's pretty boring to listen to a large list of things that maybe you're not even in Edinburgh and can't see, but hopefully we've excited you for a bit of the taste. We're going to try to give you a taste on the podcast of what it feels like to be a literary podcaster during the Fringe Festival. But now we're going to go back in time a little bit. Last time I was in London, I got a chance to sit down with the great Mario Petrucci. Hope you enjoy it, and definitely take a moment, go online, have a look at some of his actual poems and stuff. He does a few readings of his own, but buy his book, Heavy Water, man. It's an incredible piece of work, and I hope you enjoy the interview. How do you think that your science background, because you were working as a physicist, was that the science?
Mostly materials scientist.
And how does that affect the writing work? I mean, having read, say, Heavy Water and things, there is. I mean, from the very beginning of the cover image, the cover image is. Would you like to describe it? Actually,
it's my own design. It's tracks of alpha particles in a cloud chamber, taken out of a sixth form textbook. And modified on my PC to look like a kind of a series of radiating lines all from one common place, which was what happened on that particular moment when the reactor went. And then all these individual lives were affected by that one event, but in very different ways, but not quite parallel-wise, you know, all divergently. All those experiences ended up in very different outcomes. But you can originate them all back to this common moment. Which is why, strangely, I think people who've been through some horrific tragedy like that feel connected, because their sense of their origins have met at some point because of the same incident that happened to them.
Yeah. I mean, from a science perspective, I mean, it's just interesting to me that, like, that's... I don't think there's that many people that would have chosen that as a cover image. You know, and then that kind of So that's how does that science background influence the book? Because the book isn't there's moments in it which is particular. I mean, certainly in Heavy War, there's stuff that I was like, oh, that's a.
There's at least two ways. I mean, the obvious way is to say that there are processes and things that happen scientifically that I've understood mathematically and in other ways, or I've actually been witness to scientific phenomena when they've happened for the first time, in terms of never having been reported before. I mean, quite mundane stuff, really, like growing a particular crystal in a particular form and watching it evolve through an X-ray pattern or so on. There's that kind of acute sensitivity to the material world that a scientist has to develop if they're going to be a good empirical scientist. But there's also the other side of that coin, which is what science doesn't do. And that's if you're careful about how you're a scientist, you know as much about this as you do the science that you actually enact, which is that science can't answer everything. And it seems to me that the thing that physics and mathematics and science will never get a handle on is the science of nothing. A physicist can't explain nothing. Whereas I think great poets, great poetry, has its hand on nothingness, on what can't be seen, on what can't be fully understood, and only made part of a distance towards in a journey. And poetry is about that. I think the great poetry is about that. Mm. So knowing that, knowing the kind of intimate material details of events and phenomena, but also that everything we see and know about everything is partial, illusory, you know, all of that informs perhaps the way I write. I think so, that yin and the yang of science. And I think what happens with science too often in the contemporary is that you only get one side of that story, what science can explain and will eventually explain, and we'll work it all out, and then you won't need anything else. That can never be true. And I think poetry stands in opposition to that. Absolutely in opposition to that. Not aggressively in opposition, but in contradistinction to it.
And do you feel like that's the two very distinct parts of your personality that kind of come together through the writing? Or do you turn it off or turn it on? That doesn't really make sense. But you say it's contradictory. So
it's about listening to where it goes. I mean, there's that great philosopher and scientist, David Bohm, who talks about the hollow movement, which is this kind of, well, it's impossible to describe what it is because it's that fluxile, unifying flux at the heart of everything from which everything emanates. And we've had so much science of an atomistic nature that, you know, you understand this bit of science and you understand that bit of behavior and they're all separate. Maybe you can make a few links and get the grand unification theory eventually that links all these parts together. But I think poetry, art, and a full consciousness tend towards what Bohm was talking about, a connection to this kind of deeper, unobservable, fluxile ocean that informs all the particularities of what we know, think, see, do, whether it's a physics experiment or falling in love. They're all parts of the same thing, like the cover of Heavy Water, all emanating from this one source. And that's what poetry in its way indicates, just as science indicates or suggests that there might be a grand unification theory. Poetry has always known that. You know, there is one source and we're all individual expositions of it.
Yeah, that's a very good answer. You're still doing things in schools and workshops and things.
Yes,
and how do you find that works? And do you, because it seems to me that that's probably a rarity.
That's very common in Britain for poets and writers to go into schools and run workshops and meet teachers and suggest that everyone might be able to do what they do.
Yeah, but I mean, by rarity, I mean your particular specialty would be when you're going in, and what kind of workshops are you delivering? You're delivering stuff that kind of encourages both literature and science, and putting that together, which is something that for a long time, people would view that as diametrically opposed. In some people,
well,
I would disagree.
Yes. I mean, it's that diametrical opposition, that whole thing with. The two cultures debate and so on, Leavis against C.P. Snow, all that kind of stuff. And it's all beside the point, really. Whether it's science or poetry or any other form of art, it's about sensitivity to the matter of what you're doing, which is where I've gone with the poetry more recently from Shrapnel and Sheets, which was published way back in 1996, which was a in some ways quite a material book, looking at the world, looking at histories, almost memoirs in poetry, that kind of thing, death of relatives, parent, and so on. And what I've moved away from towards is, sorry, what I've moved towards is a sense of poetry as this originating force which can be responded to in any moment. So you don't have to tell a story, you don't have to have a particular memory in mind. You can let the language and the pressure of existence and consciousness guide the language and be the vehicle for it.
And, I mean, this is an interesting thing to me, which is, so Shrapnel and Sheets came out, and as you said, and it has some, you know, it's got a very distinct style, and then Heavy Water, of course, has got its own, explores the Chernobyl disaster, and then now you've got I, Tulips, which appears to me to be radically different. And is this a conscious choice? As you sat down, is this development conscious, or was it just sort of how you were moving?
I thought it was a very definite decision to follow the kind of mid-century American modernists, you know, those three great schools of American poetics, which were actually incredibly diverse and hugely overlapped, the New York school, the Objectivists, and the Black Mountain. You know, they all knew each other or didn't know each other, and there was, I think it was all part of one thing, which was a responsiveness to language in the moment of its inception, in different ways, different models to that. And I thought I was beginning to work with that more consciously, but when I look back in my files, going as far back as 94, 95, and even earlier, I find prototypic versions of the I, Tulips poems in little things I'd written or in passages of poems that I didn't think were working and put away. And so it's always been there. And that's that great debate between nurture and nature. The secret is always there. You've always got access to it. You started with it, but you have to find it as though it never existed. That's the paradox. That's what you could write books about, with people in their shores, standing on mountains, waiting for... You know, that's all part of yourself. That's all a psychological paradigm or metaphor for what we have to do with ourselves as artists. We have to find what we've already known and always known, as though we'd never known it, and come to it afresh.
And when you would be putting together Shrapnel and Sheets... And you, because you said you had these poems for a long time, these I, Tulips poems, the prototypical ones. Do you remember being dismissive of them or anything like
that? No, I was absolutely connected with them, still am. But, you know, I've just more recently become aware of a bigger picture to poetry. When I started out, it was just about my individual personal responsiveness to the poem that I was in the middle of. And that should be enough, but nothing's ever enough for me, I'm afraid. I'm always looking behind and under. It's a big trouble for myself. But it also leads you to look at things you might carry on doing a whole lifetime if you didn't challenge them. And I've begun to wonder what a poet does. Let's talk about poetry in particular. What a poet does in an age when you've had modernism, postmodernism, we've tried all the variations. You know, there's something slightly aghast about poetry now. What do we do next? You know, where can we go? And it's sunk into the confessional, the personal moment, rendered with as much virtuosity as you can muster. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. But the question I'm asking is the same question Eliot asked. How can we make the modern world possible for art? That's what he said. The modern world possible for art. So that's what I'm asking. How can I make an art that's accessible and open and can be reached by almost anyone who is willing to have a go, and yet hasn't sacrificed anything, is fully authentic, however complex that might be? And the kinds of questions I was asking is, can experimental poetry, the avant-garde, does it have to be obscure? Does it have to be difficult? Does difficult poetry have to be impermeable? And I just have this instinctual belief that it doesn't. That you could have absolutely clear lyrical moments that are utterly experimental and avant-garde. I mean, I could read one from I, Tulips.
Yeah, please do, because I've read some of it, and we actually workshopped some of it at the Scottish Poetry Library. I can't remember which one now, but
okay.
You know, really delightful to kind of pick apart. And it, in reading it seemed incredibly challenging originally, but as soon as people started to sit down and actually think about what was actually being said and written, it then became very clear and very precise, but in this very, almost very challenging form.
Yes. The image I have of that sometimes is when you're leaning over water, and immediately what you see on a particular kind of day with the light behind you is your own face and the clouds scudding along behind your head. And it's just what you already know. But then as your eyes adjust, and if you stay with it, you begin to realize there's depth to this fluid, and you begin to see there's movement down there, and there's all kinds of activity that you could have just ignored because you were looking at the reflection. So I think what you can do is you can have many forms of poetry where the surface is very alive and active and immediately there, and yet with kind of dedication and commitment, all kinds of levels reveal themselves. So, I mean, a poem like this, What If Climbing Mountain Is Less, that's the title, all the titles of these poems run into the poem, is a very formalized piece. I mean, most of the poems in the book are beveled tercets, three-line stanzas that go in and out, ebb in and out, all with one breath, none of them with very much punctuation apart from the odd dash and dot. So looking at this, you think, well, it's almost like language poetry. It might be a form of language poetry. But when you read it, you might begin to glimpse this simpler, more limpid, but very richly complex, I hope, subaqueous quality.
I would agree. Let's hear this.
What if climbing mountain is less defying weight, more a matter of placing one hand where the other was, as rock face slips beneath you, one thumb hold at a time? That all but holy mass, loaded with pleasure, so tender, precise, practiced as a lover, falling only at your pace, meeting meter with measure, and going down so you may imagine you ascend, thrilling even to your slight mistakes, till at last both quicken into ease, whose summit opens to cupping gasp and parts for uninterrupted blue, where, humble and lifted, you view in watering eyes how desire made a whole earth dive, yet kept you where you were.
Do you read these often at readings, the iTulip poems?
Yes, I am now. The book's been out 3 months. I've got to do something with them.
Have you been worried about it at all? Because they are challenging. I think they require rereading.
Yes, I had a crisis before it went to press. I just thought, everyone's going to hate this. Nobody's going to respond to it. And then I thought, what's that about? That's about ego. That's some kind of fear born of an expectation of how a book must be received or how one would like it to be received. And then I remembered writing the poems and how that was an authentic experience for me, and I have to trust that. And whether or not people reflect that back to me, they are in the main, I think, but whether or not it comes back to me in that form, that people feel that it moves them and that they get something from it, whether or not that actually happens, can't change the experience I had in writing them. And that's what I've got to stay with. I don't think you can write for a readership or in fear of a readership. There's that great quote from Hugh McDermott where he says, great work cannot be combined with surrender to the crowd. Great work cannot be combined with surrender to the crowd. And that sounds elitist, but it's not. It's actually saying, if you're true to yourself, if you stand apart, then people can see what you are and who you are. Then it's their choice how they respond to it. And it's quite permissible for them to say they don't think it's very good. But you have to start with that.
Mm. I think that's an amazing quote, actually. Do you, because when we spoke first about, I guess when I first met you at Stanza, we talked a little bit about the American poets that kind of influenced iTulips.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering kind of how, you said to me something that I'm slightly embarrassed by, but it's essential. I mean, it's essential reading. You shouldn't even be writing. I'm probably misquoting you grossly, but it was like, if you haven't read these things, you're not doing your job as a writer.
Please correct.
I didn't put it that pompously.
Please correct me.
I probably did, actually. I think I was being quite intense about something I feel very strongly, which is, it's rather like somebody saying, I love painting and I want to make a vocation of this, but I've never heard of Picasso. Who's Picasso? I mean, you wonder what they're doing to have missed something like that. And I think anyone who's read poetry, who knows nothing at all about American modernism or British modernism, is missing a huge part of the story, a crucial part of the story. I mean, just to give you a sense of this, Zhukovsky, you know, hardly read over here, I mean, slightly known perhaps, maybe that's not fair judgment, but that's my impression. And he came up with I think it was a definition of poetry, I'm not sure, but he described poetry as an integral sign, the mathematical integral sign between speech as the lower limit and music as the upper limit. And that's so elegant and condensed and precise. You may or may not agree with it, but just a way of thinking about poetry using a mathematical sign that makes complete sense. How do you integrate ordinary speech as we're using now with this sense of music, musicality that informs poetry in all those guises of rhyme and rhythm and onomatopoeia and so on? How do you form something between those two that makes a oneness, a one thing? That's the poem. And he instead of talking about it for 5 minutes, as I've just done, he made this notation. Now, you've got to follow a mind like that for a few minutes just to see what they're up to, if nothing else.
Who else would you say would be other from the American schools? Who else would you name as influences?
You've got to name Frank O'Hara and George Oppen. I mean, really, the classic ones, Robert Duncan, Robert Creeley, all for very different reasons. You know, Wallace Stevens, not quite in any of those groups, you could argue, but, you know, some absolutely seminal writers in terms of how one thinks about poetry, how one orients oneself towards writing and what one does with it when it started. And this whole idea that, and this is not defining those writers I've just mentioned in any way, this is my own take on it. Two things. Now, this idea, first of all, that writing is something that happens while you're writing. Philip Larkin talks of poetry as a way of pickling experience, so you can reproduce it in the reader. You know, rather like a test run, you know, where you have a drug and it produces the same result in everyone who uses it. I used to like that, but now I've changed. I might change back, but I kind of balk at that idea that I'm trying to recreate in you exactly what happened for me, as opposed to express the precise and musical and speech-driven representation of a moment of experience that you can look into yourself and it opens up something for you.
Do you think this change in terms of like no longer wishing to pickle experience, for instance, do you think this change has been because you've captured that? I mean, I think, and maybe this is a time to sort of move in. Maybe Heavy Water isn't a great example, or some of the poems from Shrapnel and Sheets, but maybe it is because there is a pickling of experience.
Yes, there is that
in those, and I think with that. Kind of outstanding accomplishment that's in Heavy Water. Do you feel that gave you the kind of I can put my guns down now, you know, and move on in this other direction? And if you hadn't done those, you would never have.
There's lots of key moments, and one of them has got nothing to do with any of the books. It was when I was poet in residence at the War Museum, and this is going back to 1999-2000. And I was trying to write a very simple piece, mostly for young visitors, about a shell going from one trench to another. And I don't know why, but I just created a string. I think it's 137 letters in a parabolic shape. And this string of letters can be read in a myriad of ways, depending on where the eye rests. But it never quite resolves into syntactical English. It has fragments of English, rather like shrapnel. And it just seemed to me that was a truer experience or measure of the experience of a shell's nature and its trajectory and its result than writing a poem about a shell hitting something or someone. Nothing wrong with doing that, but I was looking for some alternative way of thinking more deeply shell-like than a human being merely observing the action of a shell, having made some, you know. But and it was that parabola with 137 letters in it, giving the reader different options, that in one way started me on this journey. Could poetry do that?
Yeah, you wanted to see what you're. I mean, I think you've become quite keen on kind of what the limits of poetry are and what this means. Can we talk a bit about Heavy Water and just sort of the process of making that book? How did it? Can you tell us just because I think everybody should probably go out and get a copy of it. But can you tell us how that began and kind of the work that went into actually getting the material for the actual poems?
It was an accident. My wife was reading a book about Chernobyl, compiled by a Russian journalist, Svetlana Alexievich, in a book entitled Voices from Chernobyl, and it was on the bedside table. And I just saw the word Chernobyl on the spine, and I think it's one of those words like Auschwitz or Bhopal. There are these proper nouns that the moment you see them, like JFK, you think, what happened that day? Where was I? You always remember. And it, suddenly this stuff flooded back. Unexpectedly, I was in the middle of tax returns. And I opened the book and started reading, and I knew instantly it was one of those books I would not put down, like Neruda's Lolita. No, it's not. Nabokov's Lolita. I picked that up and couldn't put it down, so it meant 2 days without food, drink. Yeah. I just had to read the whole thing, not because of what I'd heard about it. And similarly for this book, I hadn't heard anything about it, didn't know it existed, but it seized me. And that started a whole relationship with those stories and those accounts as given by the people who were there, that I had to stay true to. It took 3 years to enact that. There was a burst of writing, I think about 86 poems in a few months, and then a colossal enterprise of editing to try and get these forms to work with what was being said without being gimmicky, without distracting from what was being said, and yet the form being fully alive. So for me, I'm a bit of a diametrist. You know, it's about the diametrics of things. On the one hand, having something over here, on the other hand, having something over there, and the tension that's generated is the energy. And that's a simplistic view, and it's not always appropriate, but it's one that I find often occurs.
Did you go and visit? Was it everything based on just this book? How deeply did you go into it?
It was a case of not trying to get in the way, and so visiting it would have been my experience. There are only a handful of poems in that book, in the sequence, I consider it one poem, that have anything to do with my thoughts on Chernobyl or radioactivity. There are some there, but in the main, it's the images, the thoughts, the accounts of those people trying to make sense of the invisible, which takes us back to where we started, you know, this nothingness. Radioactivity was a kind of nothingness that had incredibly profound effects on everyone who was exposed to it. You couldn't see it. You could sometimes just about smell it. This is kind of electricity in the air. But it was that, again, that tension between not being able to see this enemy, this aggressor, and yet knowing it was completely going to dictate your future, perhaps. And poetry, more than prose, I think, can get to something like that.
Hmm. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I trained as a... I admired the book for so many reasons, and also the war poems as well that appear in Shrapnel and Sheets. but yeah, as a journalist, which is what I was doing before, I ended up doing a book about Lockerbie as a journalist, and I just found it. I think that was kind of the end of, well, one of the many ends of my journalism career, which was realizing this was not an accurate way to do justice to this thing that's happened, you know. And it really felt, what's impressed me about that book is how authentically right and it feels, you know, in terms of the voices that are captured there, and the what do we call it, do you call it in the beginning testimony or testifying?
I think the testimonies, I think that's what I've called,
I think that's it. Yeah, I mean, that kind of really felt general. And then as a journalist, you can't capture it as a journalist. I think you probably couldn't,
but that's the receptivity you're bringing to the book as a reader. I mean, everything we read is reflecting ourselves. It's that water image I gave. When you read a book, you're really reading yourself. You're seeing your own reflection and your own clouds behind you. And it's only when you stay with something you're reading that you begin to discern the more universal forces. I mean, sometimes it hits you right between the eyes, but more often I find that you've got to stay with it long enough and in a variety of ways to get the full sense of what it is you have. And I think, I mean, there are forms that meet particular happenings. I remember when I was in the basement of the War Museum reading through the letters and journals, there was one incident of a soldier who'd written a letter in prose to his daughter back home in case he didn't come home. So he was trying to cram a lifetime's fathering into this one letter. And the prose wasn't able to contain it. Maybe a novel or a play would have been able to, but this fairly short letter wouldn't carry that weight. And it was incredibly sad and poignant, partly because of that reason. And it occurred to me while I was reading that letter that the poem is when the soldier doesn't come home, and the prose piece is when he does. So when you've got scope and extent and time to actually be there and say all the things you wanted to say and live them out gradually, progressively, that's prose. When you need something now to meet this immediate moment you're in, it tends to be poetry.
Huh. That's a really interesting distinction. I'm fascinated by the work at the residency at the War Museum. How long were you there for?
Good question. It was a few months on poetry placement with the Poetry Society, but I stuck around for 2 years. At my own expense, I hasten to add. But no, I couldn't leave the place. I mean, so many riches down in the on the bookshelves. I mean, these absolutely obscure writers doing crazy things or incredibly dull things who were immensely famous in their time, and now nobody knows who they are. It was just an incredibly fascinating place to live with this old, dead experience, but also the way that still lived and had all the vitality when it was pulled off. And it was a great instruction to me to read through this mass of stuff to see where it stayed alive and where it didn't stay alive, where it was stuck in its time and where it transcended its time. And it seemed to me the ones that transcended their times were the ones that had this finger on the nothing, you know, on the universal nothing, and were reaching for it and rather than simply saying what was there.
Can we hear some of these poems? Because we've talked an awful lot longer than we thought. But that's okay. It was a really good talk. But let's hear some.
I'll read you another one from I, Tulips, and maybe a short one from Flowers of Sulphur. Which,
yeah, that would be great.
But again, just to show this idea that an experimental poem needn't be, and I don't know why we think it might be, obscure or difficult. Part of that's due to Eliot, maybe, in his thinking about what modernism had to do. But I consider this a fully-fledged modernist poem. This light shows through you as dusk where you turn, addressed by our window, as though you wore gauze of being here more lightly when I yearn through you for light beyond you. Yet I learn the firmest sight can hold on to tonight is that shaping and shaped by almost here fern-coloured dress.
Thanks, Mario, and thanks again to the Letting Agency that let us do that interview in their atrium. That was very nice of you. Thanks to our producer, Colin Fraser, and the Scottish Poetry Library gang. We'll see you all at the book festival, and of course, Ewan McLean with the incidental music. This podcast would be nothing without him. We'll see you next week.
This podcast is a member of the Association of Poetry Podcasting
at poetrypodcasting.org.